Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my colleague, the esteemed, the one, the only, Payne Insider. And Payne, it's a big night tonight. Do you have any idea why it's a big night in sports?
I do. Should I just pretend I don't?
I mean, if you want, you can share it. So hopefully you're going to bring that same energy, that enthusiasm, and it has nothing to do with the wild card game between the Astros and Athletics.
I'm a huge
hockey fan. That's a nice appetizer. There we go. Now we're talking. Opening night, baby. Get excited.
Oh, yeah. Who does Pittsburgh have tonight?
They actually don't play because they're not all that relevant in the grand scheme of things in the NHL landscape.
Here we go.
So we get the last two Stanley Cup champions. We got a little revenge scenario in my backyard for the Golden Knights and Sharks.
Is that game located?
T-Mobile Arena, baby. I'll be there in the flesh, at least if I get my NFL prep work done for tomorrow's podcast.
Oh, guys, you're living the life, man. You're out every night of the week these days.
Here we go. Every night of the week, my ass.
I just don't want you continuing to kill the credibility. If I find out on social media you're riding like a tricycle on the ice again, I mean, this podcast may just blow up.
You know what? The organization still actually owes me. I think I was the first one to go out there on the ice in between periods for a preseason game in the inaugural season, and they never sent me my prize for going out there and dusting the competition. But
really?
That's a diff. Yeah, I feel bitter about it now that you brought it up. That was a painful memory that had scabbed over, and now I'm going to have to try and figure out if I have any recourse for that. One thing I'll address, we'll get it out of the way right at the top of the show. College football teams or NFL teams, when they play a bad game, they kind of bury the game ball, they bury the tape. That's the only reference I'm going to make to what happened Friday night in College Park. So we're going to put that to bed. We took a lot of slack for it. Maryland didn't quite show up the same way we thought they would against Penn State.
I got to be honest with you. I think at this point, our loyal listeners were fantastic. And I think that's the one big thing I always take away. Of course, you're going to have the guy who listens to the podcast for the very first time. His friend tells him how great it is. And that's his first experience with us. And there are certainly a number of people that chirped, but when you look at the percentage of people who chirped on social versus how many listeners we have, it's really a minute percentage. And so, again, we thank the loyal listener for that. They understand what we've done since 2014 here with Best Bets. You're not going to win them all, and it sucks to have a blowout in that fashion, but whether you lose by one or 59, it's the same result. Unfortunately, we got back on the horse there Sunday with the Carolina Panthers plus the points winning outright. So if your bad weeks are 1-1, then it's going to be a pretty successful season, and that's what it's been so far this year so far with Best Bets. It's been the case since 2014. It's why the listenership has grown so much. And it's just, you know, it's what we do. And we've got a couple comments, you know, about, you know, giving out more picks and Best Bets. Our goal here is to inform you on these games, find out where each team has their advantages, to teach you kind of how to handicap on your own. Because the reality of the situation is there's 130 teams in college football. There's, you know, 30 plus, you know, 16 plus games in the NFL some weeks. So we're only here for so long. You're going to be betting some of these games on your own. So teaching you what to look for is vital. We're always going to have the best bet, but we're not going to be that podcast that gives out picks on every single game. It's just not going to happen. And in the current climate of our space, right, I think makes the method we choose even more valuable. If you want picks on every single game, just turn on your local radio. Every single guy who's not qualified to be giving out picks is giving out picks. If you want that, go for it.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. What we try and do here is a little bit different. We're trying to raise the level of discussion. I think, as you mentioned, our listenership that's grown exponentially year over year. Our listeners appreciate that. Hey, we love the banter back and forth. You know, this is a business where if you hit 56%, you're doing damn well for yourself. I do have one last thing, and then we'll get into some of the games this week, Payne. So my old man loves to bust my balls. Obviously, one of our biggest fans, bets all the games that we talk about and go through. He said, man, he said, I went back and looked through my notes. He said, I don't remember the last time you gave me a game that lost by 52 points. I said, you know what, Dad? The nice part about it is, hey, if we would have lost by a hook, that hurts a lot more. At least you were able to save the rest of the night and catch up for everything that was left on your DVR. So I even get the abuse inside the own family. And like we always talk about, the money we lose betting these games hurts a hell of a lot more than what people are going to say to us on social media.
Exponentially.
So that is the nature of the beast. And it's a perfect segue into more fun on Friday Night Football under the lights, where Central Florida takes their long winning streak in the American Athletic on the road to historic Nippert Stadium. We're looking at UCF, a 4-point road favorite, total in this game 60 at Fox Bet. And you'd have to say that the winner of this game probably has the inside track from the AAC for the Cotton Bowl. UCF, a 17-game league winning streak. And when you look at the way the last three meetings have gone, not all with Luke Fickell at the helm of Cincinnati, 113-29 for the Golden Knights, 38-13 last year when game day was in attendance. But Payne, so much of this UCF team, and we've been as high on their quarterback situation as maybe anybody in the country, didn't quite exactly pass his test with flying colors when he took things on the road to Pittsburgh earlier this season.
And that's what I think I'm fascinated most to see, right? What is his growth? He's going to be an absolute stud, but he's a freshman, so we've seen a lot of inconsistencies. Went 7-for-19 against FAU. Then you mentioned the Pittsburgh game there. Struggled a little bit with his accuracy, but overall, full season, Gabriel's been fantastic. Sixth best passer rating in the country. And kind of as you alluded to, we've thought Gabriel was the right guy for the job. So I'm happy to see Josh Heupel not, you know, screw the pooch with the quarterback position. He put Gabriel in there very early on. When I look at the matchup on this side of the ball, it's early on in the season. And so I always like to use the most comparable data point that we have, and I think it's obvious, and you kind of alluded to it, is Gabriel in the UCF offense against the Pittsburgh defense. And so when you look at Cincinnati's defense, you look at Pittsburgh's defense, both top 30 in overall defensive efficiency, I don't think there's a reason really to include the other four teams UCF's played, because average out to 92nd in defensive efficiency. When I went back and looked at Gabriel in the Pittsburgh game, wasn't overly effective on standard downs. That's usually a down that you want your young quarterback to throw on. He averaged 4.3 yards an attempt on those early downs. On passing downs, I thought Pitt did a pretty good job creating pressure. They got to Gabriel, sacked him four times, picked him off on a passing down. So that'll be the interesting matchup here. And when you look at Cincinnati's defense, that's where they've been the strongest, right? They've allowed quarterbacks to complete less than 51% of their passes. That's top 10 in the country. That's with Justin Fields in the fifth most efficient Ohio State offense in that four-game sample. So for me, when I look at this on the road, hostile environment, it'd be nice, I think, for UCF to have some success on the ground, whether it's McCray, Killens, or Anderson. It'll be key here to help Gabriel out. Really tough offense, obviously, for Cincinnati to game plan for, because they can beat you with the run and the pass. Interesting to see this. The Knights are actually one of two teams in the country that's top 10 in both explosive running and passing. Oklahoma's the other. So Cincinnati has to do a good job kind of stomping out the ground game, force Gabriel to be a thrower in known passing situations, and maybe overwhelm him a little bit and create some turnovers. That's the key here. But Cincinnati's pass defense has been pretty exceptional so far.
What do you make of the other side of the ball? We've seen erratic performances, I guess might be the best way to describe Desmond Ridder so far this season. Against Miami of Ohio a few weeks ago, under 50% passing for sub 200 yards. Didn't have to be at his best as the Bearcats smothered the Redhawks in that game. But last week against Marshall, 18 of 22, 221 yards. Ran the ball effectively, 9 carries for 48 yards. And Cincinnati, you know, I watched a portion of that game. They looked absolutely tremendous against a Marshall team that I thought was going to provide a lot more resistance. I know Cincinnati took money in the market, closing about four and a half being bet up from three. But what do we make of that side of the ball? UCF's defense always feels like it gets undersold, but they have athletes there. Can Cincinnati do enough there to put some pressure on the young quarterback and maybe force UCF to play from behind?
Desmond Ridder is the key here. And, you know, Luke Fickell was pretty direct this week when asked why his offense looked so good against Marshall. He flat out said, hey, we had some balance and we're tougher to stop that way. And it's, you know, in other words, Desmond Ridder needs to be able to threaten the defense with his arm. He did that against Marshall. I think the key here is, and just from what I've been hearing around there, is Desmond Ridder appears to be 100% healthy right now. And he dealt with some ankle stuff late last season. It dragged into spring ball. So he looked a little healthier stepping into throws. He was able to move a little bit more with his legs, as you alluded to. Obviously a huge test here for, you know, him against UCF's defense. They're 26th in overall defensive efficiency on the side of the ball. I was pretty surprised by that. But anyways, I went back and looked yesterday. Desmond Ridder has played three games against top 50 defenses in overall efficiency in his two playing seasons at Cincinnati. He's been there 3 years, obviously, but he redshirted as a freshman. The Bearcats are 0-3 in those games against top 50 defenses. Ritter's only completed 48% of his passes in those games, has zero touchdowns, two picks. Since his offense has averaged 8 points per game in those three contests. So, you know, Ridder obviously is the key here. Needs to step up as the competition rises, and that's what he's going to face here. I think the offensive line needs to be better. Coming into the season, that was, I think, a question mark we had. I know we didn't break down Cincy on the preview podcast, but they lost three starters along the own line. Two of those guys were all-conference players. So you look, Ritter's been pressured far too often right now. The splits are staggering, right? Like Ritter's completing like 40% more of his passes when there's no pressure versus under pressure. Prior to the Marshall game, which is a defense that, you know, just inside the top 100 in efficiency. So certainly you like to see a good performance, but it's not really a great measuring stick. But prior to the Marshall game, Ritter was completing 29% of his passes under pressure for 3.8 yards an attempt. And we have a UCF defense that has been creating havoc, that has been getting after the quarterback, that's been putting offenses in negative situations. They've created 58 negative plays so far. But what is interesting, the one thing that I kind of have some hesitation about when it comes to UCF's defense is games where the opponent was somewhat close, they've given up some rushing yards, right? Even the Stanford game, it wasn't overly close early. But Stanford's three running backs average 5.7 a carry. Pittsburgh's two running backs average 5.5 a carry. Running the ball, I think, with Warren is really, you know, the identity of the Bearcats offense. So if they can keep this game close where, you know, handing it off to Warren is still an option, I think they have some success here moving the ball on UCF.
It should be an interesting game. Cincinnati hasn't exactly been great when you look at how they've performed against ranked opponents. You have to go all the way back to 2009 to find the last time they beat a team that they welcomed in that was inside the AP Top 25. Imagine it'll be a great atmosphere at historic Nippert Stadium. One last thing on this number pain. We've seen it kind of ping pong around. Every time it gets to 4.5, there appears to be immediate buyback. Safe to say there's a little bit of an appetite from professionals on the dog here.
That has been the case, and I know you'll see, you know, an opener of 3.5, but it did shoot out to 4.5 at that number. There was some buyback on the dog. You know, it's a Friday night game. It's a standalone game. The public's certainly going to have their say here, and the public got there in this same time slot last week with Penn State. So it'll be interesting to see what this line does, but yes, I think we're going to see pros on Cincinnati here. And it's interesting, right? You mentioned that home crowd. It's vital for the underdog, the lesser team, to get out to a good start and allow that crowd to get into the game and be effective. That wasn't the case last week with Maryland. It's really important here, just as like a little last nugget on this game, that Cincinnati plays fundamental football, that they play situational football, that they don't beat themselves. And what I mean by that is Cincinnati right now, 123rd in the country in penalty yards, situationally 115th in red zone scoring. They have three turnovers in the red zone. If you're going to upset UCF here, those two things have to improve.
There's no doubt your margin for error sometimes when you have a lot less explosive playmakers becomes narrow, and you're better off playing from the catbird seed than you are playing catch up. From a Friday night football game, we'll head out west, Payne, where Oregon finds themselves pretty large and substantial favorites as they welcome in the California Golden Bears. 18 points, the going rate right now. Total in the game, 45.5 at Foxbet. And for a Cal team that started off undefeated, they saw the other shoe come crashing down. Chase Garbers injures his shoulder. Devin Modster takes over. And you look at the way that this Cal offense performed. They come right out of the half. They run the ball right down Arizona State's throat. And that's where things start to get off the tracks a little bit. California, over the next five drives, 6 of 19, a punt. Three-play drive, no yards, a punt. Four plays, no yards. They kick a field goal after a turnover. And their final two drives both come short on downs. They gain a grand total of 11 yards. Going on the road against an Oregon team off a bye who's played well on the defensive side of the ball, I can't imagine it's going to be a very rosy outlook for Justin Wilcox and the boys.
Really interesting, obviously. You know, Devin Monster came in to replace Garbers after he went down late in the second quarter. And we talked on the preview podcast that I thought and everything I heard was Garbers was improving tremendously. And, you know, he's not elite by any stretch, but he certainly has played better this year than last. And so this is a little bit of a downgrade. And you mentioned this when Monster came in, he had seven total drives the rest of the way. Cal averaged 2.65 yards per play on the 38 snaps post Garbers injury. So not very good. I do want to say that, you know, it's tough to get any worse, right? So I think we see some level of improvement knowing that Monster's going to, you know, have a game plan geared specifically for him. You know, he's going to have all the practice reps this week. And, you know, if you're a Cal fan, I guess the one kind of thing that you have in your cap, you can go back to, and it's like, hey, there was a five-game sample in 2017 for Monster when he was at UCLA, and you know, some of it was mop-up duty, some of it was filling in for Rosen when he was injured. But Devin Monster completed 65% of his 79 attempts there, and he averaged 9.5 adjusted yards per pass attempt with four touchdowns and no picks. He had a 153 rating. So my feeling is it's going to look better than Friday night against ASU. It's not going to look nearly as good as he did at UCLA. So I think we're working with something, you know, kind of in the middle here. I'm just, you know, either way, I'm not sure I see a situation where Cal has much success offensively. And the one thing that we hoped for in the offseason was, hey, we know what Cal's defense is going to be. Let's just see some improvement on offense. And I think the joke was, and that's kind of how the joke came about, right? Go from like being horrific to just bad.
Yeah. And, well, I think the quote was just be below average. I think was the quote that our listeners were clamoring for on a t-shirt.
So, you know, we were like, hey, improvement would be like Cal getting into the 90s in offensive efficiency because they were like 115th last year. And we knew what we would get from their defense. So right now, Cal's like in the 90s in offensive efficiency. So that's the improvement we were looking for year over year. But the problem is defensively, Oregon's made an even larger leap. And the talent on that side of the ball is starting to finally produce. Like there is bona fide NFL draft picks at every level of the Ducks defense. And so you have this situation where Cal is stepping up in class based on an average efficiency ranking of the defenses they've played so far. And Oregon's going in the opposite direction, right? They're taking a step down in class. So that's going to be really interesting to monitor. I think the other issue here is Cal's O-line. And they've just allowed defenses to create a lot of havoc up front, a lot of negative plays, 49 negative plays so far allowed by Cal this season. The offense isn't good enough to overcome that against a good defense, I don't think. You know, and you look at Cal's offense outside the top 70 explosive passing. Oregon right now, four games, has created 12 negative plays on average per game. And so they haven't allowed chunk plays either. Just 10 chunk runs, 11 explosive passes all season. So how is Cal going to be able to operate from behind the chains? It's going to be difficult to do, you know? And credit to Andy Avalos so far, right? That's a hire that I didn't believe would be overly impactful because we saw him at Boise with better talent than the rest of the conference, and he churned out like two seasons outside the top 40 in defensive efficiency. So I was wrong there so far. So credit to Andy Avalos. And I think, you know, with the bye week, we're probably going to see some new things implemented in against a new quarterback. The other interesting thing here is where Cal's starting field position is going to be. And I think it's important that even if Cal isn't scoring points on drives, that they're not getting absolutely crushed in the field position battle, because the Ducks punter, Jacob Archer, is fantastic, averaging like 47 yards a punt. So if we see Cal constantly backed up, it's going to be really tough for them to score here.
You mentioned Oregon's defense, and some of these numbers for me were staggering, because every time you think about Oregon, it's always that high-flying offense, Justin Herbert and some of their playmakers there. They've allowed just 15 points since their season-opening loss to Auburn. Now, I know it wasn't a murderer's row, Nevada, Montana, and Stanford, but still impressive nonetheless. And when you look at how they performed against FBS opponents, holding their opponents to 3.7 yards per play, second in overall pass D, and you mentioned some of those playmakers. We knew about Kevon Thibodeau and what he could bring there. Clearly, everybody has created that galvanizing effort. When we look on the other side of the ball and coming into the season, I think, Payne, we would have been led to believe that it's strength on strength with the Oregon offense against the Cal defense. Justin Herbert hasn't really disappointed as far as his numbers on paper. 74% completion percentage, 14 touchdowns, no interceptions. But the ground game has really been lacking. The playmakers, from an explosive standpoint, to my untrained eye in Oregon, appear to be a bit deficient. And the one thing, I look at Oregon's numbers, this is still a football team that scored 35 or less points in three out of their four games so far this season.
Yeah, it's a huge test for Oregon's offense, and I think we'll find out what this unit is and can be, and if they're a legitimate, you know, Pac-12. I mean, they are a Pac-12 contender, but I think maybe even past that, you know, if they run the table, I think there's maybe a possibility that they can sneak in. I don't know. But this is a massive test, a second big test for Marcus Arroyo. We kind of focused on him and signaled him out against Auburn as being a key to that game. Right now, his offense is 45th in efficiency against a schedule of defenses that ranks 73rd in defense efficiency. So not what I don't think any of us expected out of Oregon's offense so far to this point. When I started breaking this game down a bit, the, again, best comparable data point for this side of the ball in this matchup is using the Auburn game. And, you know, because Auburn's defense, 18th in efficiency, Cal 25th right now. They've slipped a little bit year over year. So it's the same weight class, though, so to speak. So the one thing that I kind of remember going back in my mind about that Auburn contest was Marcus Arroyo needing to trust and lean on his NFL quarterback a little bit more and having Justin Herbert throw the ball on early downs. And I went back and looked yesterday, excluding the halftime kneel down and then obviously the Hail Mary to end the game. Oregon had 13 drives against Auburn. When Arroyo allowed Herbert to throw on first down at any point within those 13 drives, Oregon scored all of their 21 points, and Oregon had an opportunity to score on four of those nine drives where Herbert, again, passed on first down at any point within the series. On the series where Arroyo didn't allow Herbert to attempt to pass on first down, there was four of them. Oregon either punted or turned it over. So again, like, I get you have this great offensive line. I get your head coach wants to be physical and pound it. Very few teams have an NFL quarterback at their disposal. You got to freaking use them. The positive, though, when I look at this, you know, for Herbert, for Arroyo, for the Ducks offense, all signs point to the beat up receiver group getting healthier. Right. I know we talked a little bit yesterday off air about this. Micah Pittman, Brendan Schooler, looks like they're going to play. Mario Cristobal was asked this week if there's something this offense hasn't shown yet or is reserved for conference play. And Cristobal flat out said in his press conference, yeah, our offense. So, you know, he's alluded to the fact that he's had to play with tight ends at wide receiver. Oregon had to convert a defensive back to receiver. Now there's weapons back. Let's see what the offense looks like. We know the Ducks O-line continues to be one of the best units in college football. They've allowed 16% pressure rate on dropbacks. That's fifth best in the Power Five. More of a reason in my mind, right, to let Herbert throw it early and often. When Oregon does run it, they have to do it to move the chains, obviously. So have the pass set up the run. I think there needs to be a running back here that you know, just takes command of the offense, shoulder the load. I mean, whether it's Verdell or Dye or Felix, someone has to emerge, I think, as the guy. And right now, despite the Oregon offensive line being top 10 in run blocking, there isn't a running back on the roster that's forced more than five missed tackles all season. So tailbacks need to play significantly better here. You know, I think when you look at how this game sets up stylistically, if Oregon can get out fast, right? And that's something Oregon has done so far. They've outscored opponents 84-15 in the first half. If you can do that against Cal, right? Force them to play catch up with a backup quarterback. I think Oregon's probably in good shape.
I figured you force more than five missed tackles when you go into the local Publix trying to chase down the green juice early in the week.
Always talk about Publix. One of the best places to find women. Got to tell you.
Hey, I mean, everybody's got their own keys to success. If a grocery store is what does it for you, I tip my hat.
Ma'am, do you need help with that cucumber?
I think you should write it in the when the autobiography of Pain Insider eventually hits bookshelves. I think there should be an entire chapter dedicated to that life mantra. Grocery stores are undersold.
Undersold, for sure. No doubt about it.
One last thing on this game. California has really thrived in the underdog role over its last 19 games. They've gone 13-6 against the spread. They've been road warriors as well. 9-4 against the number the last 13 on the highway. But you look at Oregon, and they've actually dominated the series. Over the last 24 meetings, Oregon's been able to take you to the window 17 out of those 24 meetings. Just things to factor in for fun discussion.
We were on
Cal
last year in this matchup, were we not? And Oregon just looked so much better athletically. Like, it was kind of tough to watch.
And that game, I think, went flying over the total, right? I don't have the numbers in front of me. I feel like there were 60-plus points scored in that matchup.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but I just remember it being close early. And then that second quarter, Justin Herbert and the receivers were just too fast and explosive for Cal's defense. So,
and I think it was a weeknight game on top of that. I remember back a couple of years, not to go too far on a tangent, was it the Friday night game with Jared Goff? I think we had him plus +3 and it went to overtime. That game, I believe, took years off my life with multiple overtimes only to get a push.
Yes, absolutely. And just, you know, the thing that we've seen from Cal's defense is they've slipped a little bit. They finished last year 13th in defensive efficiency. We thought this was a team that would slip into the top 10. They've kind of regressed a little bit to 25th. And the one area where they dominate is usually in the trenches. And that's kind of where Oregon has their success. So if Cal's defensive line can't dominate this game, which, you know, they're probably not going to be able to do down in and down out, it really makes their defense not as good overall in my mind.
And this was a Cal team. They faced a passing attack. We saw them struggle in SEC country. We'll see if that manifests itself Saturday night up at Autzen Stadium. From the Pac-12 to the Big Ten, it's Michigan, a 3.5-point home favorite. Total in the game, 47 at Fox Bet as they welcome in the Iowa Hawkeyes. And before we get into some of the matchups here, Payne, I want to ask your honest assessment. We saw this number open substantially higher. We've seen money come in on the underdog. There's a shop out here in the desert that the number got as low as 3. Immediate buyback on Michigan. When we look at just the point spread and the adjustment, I mean, a combination of factors here, the market just looking to sell Michigan stock and try and buy on Iowa, or what have we seen in your circles as far as the way these two teams are being approached?
So I looked this morning, I saw the look ahead line this summer was Michigan minus 10.5. Is that right?
It was a lot bigger. I believe it was in double digits. I don't know exactly where it was during the summer though.
Interesting. Man, I think I have the sheet here. Yeah, it was 10.5. And so maybe it was larger at one point, but that's the sheet that I have. Maybe that was like right before game started. So, you know, when you look at this game at like 3-point, let's call it like 2 right now based on the juice, significant adjustment, I would think, when you look at these two teams and figure out where the credit for that adjustment's coming, I would probably say 80-10. Right, in favor of Michigan, you know, disappointing, and why this line's adjusted maybe 20% with how Iowa's played at this point. So I was looking, and I hate to always do this, but big games like this, I do usually take a little gander at the bet splits. Right now it looks like Iowa's the public dog. Everyone is selling their Michigan stock. Should be interesting to see how this plays out, but as you kind of mentioned there was one shop that got to 3, and that didn't last very long.
All right, let's start this game, and we can go one of two ways, and I'll leave it up to you. Do we want to talk Iowa offense against the Michigan defense, or do we want to talk Michigan offense against the Iowa defense?
Well, both, but you can lead us to where this ship starts.
All right.
Just don't run us into an iceberg.
I'm gonna do my best. So, all right, let's start with the Michigan offense then, because that's clearly been a unit that's drawn all sorts of ire from talking heads. And sure, maybe they got things right in the win against Rutgers, but it is a win against Rutgers, 52-0. These two teams share multiple common opponents, Middle Tennessee State and Rutgers, with very different results in those two contests. Michigan so far this season averages 392 yards offensively and 32 points per game. That ranks 10th and 9th in the Big Ten, respectively. They finally had their first 300-yard passing game of the Josh Gattis era, and I think a lot of that pain can be attributed to a healthy Donovan Peoples-Jones, 4 catches, 62 yards, and a touchdown. But Michigan has really struggled to run the football. I don't think this is the kind of opponent where their ground game gets on track.
We will see. I think it's a good test to see if Michigan looks a little different against a good team. If they don't, against the second really good team they've played, I think it's time to really downgrade the Wolverines, because there are a lot of professional bettors that have been hesitant to do so. Obviously, you know, they're outside the top 10 now, but it hasn't been this, you know, precipitous drop off where we think, hey, we've just fully given up on Michigan. There were big changes made last week against Rutgers, and that was pretty clear. There was a lot of talk leading up to the Rutgers game about being more physical. So one thing that Harbaugh did at practice leading up to Rutgers was ones versus ones. And that's very rare for him. Usually Harbaugh has ones play against the scout team. And what I saw against Rutgers and what the metrics say is the Wolverines offense got back to some of the basics up front in the way they blocked in the run game. A lot more, you know, zone schemes similar to what Michigan's O-line ran last year before Gattis took over. 53% of Michigan's runs against Rutgers had a zone blocking element. And you look, those zone runs accumulated 114 of the 144 rush yards last week against Rutgers, 5.4 yards a rush on those zone runs and a touchdown. So hopefully we see a little bit more of that against Iowa this week. There's obviously, you know, two common opponents that these two teams have faced, right, in Rutgers and MTSU. But right now, through four games, Iowa's average efficiency ranking of the offenses faced is 84th in the country. The one top 50 offense that Iowa's faced so far in Iowa State, the Cyclones outgained Iowa by almost 3.5 yards per play, put up 2 yards more than the national average, and it was a goddamn downpour. Right. And so
hey, we had the under there. Shout out to the Iowa State students that were out there making that track extra sloppy for us to get to the window in the first half, by the way.
Did you see that? Oh, after the first weather break, the fans were still at the game. They somehow got onto the field and were just tearing that puppy up, sliding all over the plate. Like, it was ridiculous. I can't believe they're allowed on the field. When I look at this, and I'm not quite sure where we left off, but, you know, the one test that Iowa's defense has had, and it was in poor weather, they didn't fare very well. So, you know, there hasn't been a defense that's really gotten after the quarterback or created a lot of havoc. Just 16 negative plays on defense. That's the lowest amount in the entire country. And so, you know, when you look at potentially the ground game getting a little bit better for Michigan, Iowa's still without defensive tackle Brady Reif. So not positive there. The one thing you look at, and hopefully it helps, and I shouldn't say hopefully, but maybe it helps Iowa's defense, is they are going to get some contributors back in the secondary. Safety Kayvon Merriweather and Julius Brents are back. Maybe we see a little bit more of the 4-2-5 cash package that Iowa likes to run. I know Kirk Ferentz in his press conference this week says that's the defensive DNA, the 4-2-5. They could only use it for one snap against Iowa State a few weeks back due to the depth issues. 9 guys on defense played every snap in that game. They only rotated 13 guys in total. They've had to kind of revert back to a 4-3, but again, you know, a little bit healthier on defense for the Hawkeyes. Maybe they're able to show a few more looks this week at the Big House. But, you know, when I look at this, I think there's a possibility where Michigan can throw the ball a little bit on the secondary. So big test here as well for Iowa's defense, because they have not been tested yet. And the one time they were, I know they won the game, but it just wasn't pretty metrically.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned it. Brock Purdy threw for 327 yards in that game, and that was with a bunch of no-names in the receiving core for Iowa State, not NFL-caliber talent like the Iowa secondary is going to see from the Michigan Wolverines. Donovan Peoples-Jones, as we talked about, Nico Collins, Tariq Black, and, of course, Ronnie Bell, who's quickly emerging maybe as Shea Patterson's most reliable target. On the other side of the ball, Payne, Iowa does a lot of the things that Wisconsin does that made them so successful against Michigan. They're third in the nation in time of possession. But this is a Hawkeyes team that doesn't wow you with anything from a big play potential. There's no NFL-caliber running back in the form of Jonathan Taylor. It's an offensive line that's good, but I don't think anywhere as close to what the Badgers are going to bring to the table. And we've actually praised Nate Stanley quite a bit. But it seems whether it's by design in the confines of this offense, 64% completion, 8 touchdowns to no interceptions, doesn't have that NFL caliber tight end, whether it was TJ Hawkinson or Noah Fant last year. They're led by Smith Marset, and they're 5 receivers with over 100 plus. But I think if you're Michigan on the defensive side, there's nothing that Iowa does offensively that really scares you, which is probably a little bit of a relief given how Wisconsin ran over, around, and through you 2 short weeks ago.
Man, was that ugly. And this is a big test for both sides, huge test for Iowa's offense. Let's see if they're legit. It's the second, you know, road game of the season, first trip to the Big House for any player on this roster. You mentioned Nate Stanley. The offense is still run first like it was last season and even a little bit more. They're passing on only 44% of their snaps. What's really been good, though, about Iowa's offense is there has been improvement from the Hawkeyes' ground game. And Brian Ferentz, give him some credit. It was a guy that we called out a little bit on the preview podcast a few months back. He's been pretty versatile offensively with what he wants to do in the ground game. And you just look at the last 2 games alone, Iowa's been very multiple with how they decide to run the ball. Drastically different in 2 games. Against Iowa State, run plays were called from 21 or 12, 50% of the time, and 11 personnel, 50% of the time. Against MTSU, completely different. Iowa ran out of 21 or 12, 88% of the time. So being versatile like that in scheming for opponent is always the best way. It's something we always talk about, right? Just don't be who you are. Kind of scheme and take advantage of your opponent weaknesses. And that's what Brian Ferentz has done so far. And you know what? Whether it's MTSU or not, 644 yards is pretty impressive last week. That was the most a Kirk Ferentz team has ever had in his 21 years at Iowa. So some positives there. I think the other positive thing for the Hawkeyes offense is it looks like they're going to get their starting left tackle back, Alaric Jackson. He's going to return. He's only played 15 snaps this season, so that's a huge get back when you're going to a hostile environment that you might have a little bit more continuity along the offensive line and your best guys out there. You know, when you look at all Iowa's offense as a whole, again, haven't really been tested yet. You know, Iowa State's defense, 24th in overall efficiency. That's basically the toughest test. And you look, the Cyclones held Iowa to a 42% success rate and 4.4 yards a play, 1.3 yards below the national average in that game. So the one test that Iowa's offense has had kind of failed it a little bit, you know? Iowa's offense in totality has played defenses whose combined average rank is 81st in defensive efficiency. So a lot here hasn't been great. When I look at Michigan's defense, they've had a ton of turnover, obviously. We knew that coming into the season, whether it was, you know, 3 key guys lost in their front 7, whether it was a defensive line coach or linebackers coach lost. Those were big voids to fill. But coming into this game, 6th still in overall defensive efficiency. They pitched the first shutout last week. I know it was Rutgers, but that was the first shutout in 3 years. So, you know, positive signs there for Michigan as well. Michael Dwumfor, the guy who I believe is the best interior lineman, finally returned against Rutgers. They thought maybe he was going to play in the Wisconsin game. He didn't. So it's a huge get back in the trenches. Mozzie Smith, Chris Hinton, 2 of the top 11 interior linemen in the 2019 class, apparently are going to start getting more reps from what I'm hearing, because not only are they more talented than some of the older guys, but they've proven to just be better players so far. So hopefully that helps stabilize the Michigan run defense a little bit, because that's what they're going to see from Iowa. As kind of I mentioned at the top, 56% run, 44% pass so far this season. So that D-line for Michigan with 1-4 back and the 2 really talented young guys potentially getting more snaps, you would think bolster that front 4 for Michigan.
You'd have to hope that you're going to get Michigan's single best effort. Season potentially slipped away in that loss at Camp Randall against Wisconsin. Things would only fall that much further if they were to drop a home date against Iowa, a potential buy low spot on the Wolverines. Anything else, Payne, on this particular game you might want to add before we shift gears from Big Ten country down to the SEC?
No, I think that's it for now.
When we look at a game nationally televised on CBS, Auburn and Florida will do battle. This number has been on the move, not necessarily when it opened this week, but from where it would have been before the season or even had the game been played last week.
By the way,
week.
I'm going to interrupt you here. Was that laugh at my conciseness or the hint for later on?
No, I don't think that was a hint. Well, now apparently you told everybody it was a hint, so they might stop listening. But no, I appreciate a man that chooses his words. He's concise and precise all at the same time. Because we joke, you know, our goal is to get in and out of an hour. Usually it doesn't happen. And we've gone through three games and contributed about 10 minutes to each of them. So
we will let you finish the back half of your will towards the end of this podcast this week.
Auburn and Florida. Auburn, a 3-point road favorite. Total on the game 48 at Foxbet right now. And when we look at public perception, we talk about it all the time, maybe more so in the National Football League than in college. I don't know if there's a team that's changed more in the national conscience than Auburn just over the last couple weeks. Auburn still undefeated against the number, 5-0. 3 weeks ago, when we talked on this very podcast for their trip to Texas A&M to take on the Aggies, nobody wanted any part of Auburn. They get a 28-20 win. They follow that up last weekend with a dominant performance against a Mississippi State team that I think is overrated. And lo and behold, we're looking at Auburn road favorites. The first time Auburn makes a trip to Gainesville since 2007. Now, I know, Payne, before we get into the X's and O's, which we're going to do, the transitive property doesn't always apply in college football. But this number tells me that Texas A&M is a 7-point favorite on a neutral field against the Florida Gators. My gut tells me, and looking at my numbers, that's not quite the case.
I wondered why you texted me this, but I know you pretty well. And I said, oh, he's going to do the transitive property thing tomorrow.
No, you know it. I tip my hand. I mean, after 5 years, I don't have a lot of tricks in my bag, and you probably know most of them at this point.
So what was it? The Gators were -6.5 in the game of the year, and then I think you texted me last night that they were -3 last week.
They were -3 last week in this game, and like we said, I mean, Auburn closed a 4-point dog at Texas A&M, and now a 3-point favorite on the road against Florida.
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly the number's a little bit inflated here. You know, for Auburn's offense, second big true road game, I guess, you know, after their trip to Kyle Field. I try to look at these comparable data points, at least early on in the season, and I think that data point there at A&M is interesting. The scoreboard probably a little, you know, misleading. Auburn was held a full yard per play below the national average against A&M's defense. That's, I think we have them 24th right now in defensive efficiency. And when A&M was able to get Bo Nix and Auburn into these known passing situations, Auburn really struggled. They did. Nix had a 29% success rate throwing the ball on known passing downs against A&M. Bo was held to 2 yards per pass attempt on those 13 passing down throws. So, you know, probably the key here again, have Florida get Auburn into these known passing situations. It's tough for me to gauge a true freshman. And it's evident to me that Nix is making strides every single week. So we're going to see a performance at some point here that's like, wow, we knew what he could be, and maybe this is what it looks like. So, you know, that is the kind of nerve-wracking thing here when it comes to Auburn's offense, that it could potentially be better. You remove, though, Kent State from the equation, and the four defenses that Bo Nix and Auburn has faced combined to average a defensive efficiency ranking of 33rd. And Nix has faced two top 25 defenses away from home so far. So I know he's been getting a lot of hate, and, you know, he can't make throws and he can't do the true freshman, man. He's been tested. I think we saw him gain some confidence last week. I know you watched the Mississippi State game more than I did. I just saw the dog almost get taken out there. That's about it. But when you look offensively there, Bo Nix had 9 explosive passes against Mississippi State. 13 of his 21 pass attempts went for a first down or a touchdown. You know, if he can consistently threaten defenses with his arm, it's going to make Auburn almost impossible to defend. The positive news, though, I think if you're Florida, if you're Todd Grantham's defense, he's getting five guys back on that side of the ball, including his best defensive end and cornerback. And I think that's going to play a role here because CJ Henderson is certainly one of the best corners in college football. Him returning, I think, is going to allow, you know, the Florida defense to attempt to close off one side of the field. It's going to allow Grantham to send more heat. The key for me, and we kind of texted back and forth the opening game, and it's been a problem for Florida all season so far, is being able to tackle in space. And that's the one thing that Gus Malzahn's offense is kind of really stress the defense with, right? Malzahn has kind of always been this guy that likes to find the open space. And once you do, like, create these one-on-one matchups where his athlete just out-athletes your guy. And so, you know, again, Florida has struggled this season defensively with missed tackles. That can't happen here. You know, the real key, though, I think, is, you know, Auburn's offense getting to play, you know, getting the ball out, you know, quickly to some of their guys. That's kind of the MO of this offense. If, and it's really, really tough to say this, but that I think is really one of the big keys, right? Can Florida make tackles? If they can't, they're going to struggle. It's the entire DNA of this offense. And I was looking this morning, last season, the national average for quarterback yardage after catch was 47%. Auburn's offense was 61%. So again, it's all about tackling well. If you do, you have a shot. The other thing that concerned me just a little bit with Florida's defense, and maybe not necessarily Florida's defense, but Grantham's defense, Malzahn and him have squared off a few times at this point. Most recently was in 2007 when Grantham and Dan Mullen were together at Mississippi State. Grantham's aggressiveness really backfired, and it got him burnt a ton. Malzahn's offense hung 42, Stidham averaged 16 yards an attempt. So it's one thing to be strategically aggressive, and I think that's what needs to be done here. It's a completely different thing running around like a headless chicken. And so that's going to be the focus, I think, for Grantham. Send pressure strategically. Just don't do it to do it, because you're going to get burnt here against this offense.
And that game, 2017, you meant, not 2007, right?
Yes, 2017, okay. I'm sorry.
Just, oh, no worries, I'm going, wait a second, Stidham, I think, is a rookie now. I wanted to make sure he didn't have Timmy Chang, like, 12 years of eligibility.
Yes, 2017.
In the college game. But, you know, you bring up some excellent points there, and we've seen Auburn's playmakers. We know they have a world-class sprinter disguised as a wide receiver out there in Anthony Schwartz, who can take the ball to the house, especially if he's in those one-on-one matchups. And you look at some interesting metrics here. Bo Nix is only going to get better. I know Auburn fans have come after me. Hey, guys, we were on Auburn week one, didn't give it out on the podcast, but we're bullish in that particular spot. But it's a market, and there's some efficiency that gets created. And you look at Auburn's offensive line. They've allowed 31 tackles for loss, tied for 88th nationally and 13th in the SEC. Meanwhile, Florida on the other side, they lead the SEC in sacks, 45 tackles for loss in five games, have intercepted or batted down 29 passes. So something's got to give there. But when we look on the other side of the ball, all the talk is about this Auburn defense. They haven't allowed more than 120 rushing yards in a game. Kyle Trask, when he took over for Felipe Franks, we knew the Gators offense pain was going to have to change a little bit. He was 18 of 20, workmanlike effort with a pair of touchdowns against Towson. Right now, completion percentage off the charts. He's not really throwing the ball downfield, and he's distributed the ball quite well. But if Florida can't run the ball here, and I don't have any expectation that they're going to be successful that way, do we trust Trask in this spot to get the ball out of his hands quickly? Because I don't think Florida has anything close to the playmakers on the edge that Auburn has on the other side.
Agreed. And, you know, I like what I've seen from Trask so far. When the injury to Felipe Franks happened, I think our mindset was a three-point downgrade. After seeing Trask play so far, and it's a really limited sample size, I think we probably overreacted initially. And I know Kentucky's defense has regressed significantly, but it's still a road game. It's against a top half defense in the country in terms of efficiency. The Vols are an absolute disaster overall, but still top 40 in defensive efficiency. So, you know, Trask has looked pretty decent. You know, he's had some mop-up duty against UT Martin. Last week against Towson was pretty good. You know, you put it all together, and you kind of alluded to this. Trask is completing 77% of his passes so far. He's averaging, you know, an adjusted 10 yards per completion. So it's not a ton of dink and dunk. He is, you know, stretching the field a little bit. He does have to limit the mistakes, though. You know, he has to be able to diagnose things before the play so he can get the ball out quickly. And I think that's probably the key on what Dan Mullen will do here. Quick passes, help that offensive line a little bit. Maybe we even see a little wildcat. We saw that previously when Dan Mullen is a little bit undermanned on offense. I think the one spot that we all have to focus on here, and it's a problem that we knew coming into the season, and you kind of brought it up here at the top, is the Gators O-line. We had question marks coming into the season. They're breaking in four new starters, right? It's shown in the run game. Guys aren't getting downhill. There's missed assignments. And as a whole, the Gators' production season over season in the ground game is dipped by, you know, like a shade under 2 yards per rush attempt. In a game like this, that can't happen. One thing we did see in the Towson game, though, Kyle Pitts, the Gators' tight end, I know he caught two touchdowns last week, but where he's really starting to contribute and where I think the Gators need his help is being a force in run blocking. And he's graded out really well as a run blocker. So having that sixth guy on the line might be something we see a lot this week against Auburn's defensive front. That's one of, you know, the best in the country. They're creating a ton of chaos, 37 negative plays created so far. I think there's even, you know, probably some noise in those numbers because Auburn's either faced really tough competition in terms of O-lines, or in the games where they haven't, guys have sat out or played like a limited role. You know, last week against Mississippi State, we saw Auburn guys, you know, they played three quarters. So they really limited Mississippi State in their time on the field. It's the reason why Auburn outgained Mississippi State well over 4 yards per play in the first three quarters when it was good versus good, starters versus starters. So the key to this is, can the Gators at least present a threat in the ground game? And you know, you don't want to be inefficient, but even if you can pick up 3 yards here, 4 yards there on the ground, it at least, you know, prevents the defense from pinning their ears back every single snap and getting after Trask, who doesn't have a lot of time in the pocket so far, and he hasn't had the ability to face a defense like this so far. So a lot of pressure. Quick passing is going to be the key. Hopefully a little bit on the ground game to help kind of balance things out a little bit. But this is the tough test, and it's really what's, you know, despite the inflated number here, Todd, and it is really inflated, it's the one hesitancy that's kept me off this game so far.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this game and it's hard to argue, and I think Auburn fans kind of took it the wrong way when I did some local radio there basically calling me Eddie Munster for making a case for Florida, is that Bo Nix in this game actually has a higher ceiling and will all season long. We know what he's going to bring to the table, but in a one-game sample size and hostile territory, it's going to be very interesting to see. He passed his first road test with flying colors against Texas A&M. I'm not going to take anything away there. I just think Florida, from a defensive standpoint, poses a very different challenge than what he's encountered thus far. And that, of course, is why they play the games and will continue to be fluid with how we diagnose both of these teams, what they are currently and what they'll be going forward. When we look at the final game, Payne, that I want to break down on today's show, Ohio State, 18.5-point home favorites. Total in this game has ticked down a little bit to 48.5 at Foxbet. They'll welcome in Michigan State. And we look at Ohio State so far this season. They've outscored their opponents 262-43. They've allowed a grand total of 17 points in two Big Ten games. Why is that relevant? Because Indiana looked like they could do whatever they wanted when they wanted against the Michigan State last weekend. And we look at Sparty, well, they haven't exactly fared so well against the Buckeyes defensively. They actually haven't scored a touchdown since 2016. They've mustered a grand total of 9 points total in the last two meetings. When we look at the Buckeyes, this was a team that I think I had questions about coming into the year. They've passed every test with flying colors. We were both bullish on Michigan State. Is this where rubber meets the road and we finally see Michigan State rise up, or does this Ohio State freight train keep heading on down the tracks?
You know, I think when you're looking at a number this tall, and it is as high as 20 some places, I don't think we're in a scenario where Michigan State is pulling off the upset. We just need to figure out if they can keep it close enough. And the big key here is, I think we know what Sparty's defense is. We can touch on them, but Michigan State's offense has to produce here. And, you know, the offensive line has to be able to hold up here. They've been a revolving door at left tackle. Top three options are out, so they've had to shift a right guard to left tackle. That's not a positive. You know, when you're coming into an environment like the Horseshoe against this ridiculous defensive line, like Ohio State has, and you have a stud in Chase Young at defensive end. He registered a 45% pressure rate last week against Nebraska, just an outrageous number. So the one thing we mentioned last week was Ohio State's defensive line creating, you know, a ton of negative plays. And that's why, you know, they ended up beating Nebraska handily because their defense owned the trenches. And that could be the case again this week. Somehow Sparty's offensive line has to manage a stalemate here most of the time because they're not an offense that can really play behind the chains. So you look at this, the Buckeyes have led the country right now, 76 negative plays created. They've backed offenses up and created 350 yards of negative plays. So again, it's tough to play behind the chains if you're anyone, especially Sparty's offense. Now, to their credit, and it's something I'm shocked to even see or say, but Brian Lewerke in Michigan State's offense, top 20 in explosive passing.
I'm not sure. I saw that too, and I tried to verify it in like multiple sources and eventually gave up because I watch that Michigan State offense. I go, I'm not sure how I feel about this.
Yeah, and listen, you know, you look at the schedule of opposing defenses that Sparty's played so far. After Western Michigan, which is outside the top 100, the other four data points that we have are all against top 25 defenses in overall efficiency. I mean, ASU and Northwestern, number 10 and 11. So the Sparty offense has faced some tough defenses so far. The other interesting thing here to keep tabs on, and it showed itself in the one loss that Sparty had to ASU, they outgained the Sun Devils in that game by like 1.3 yards per play, I believe over 200 yards in total. The problem was when Sparty got into the green zone, they couldn't convert. Right, Sparty's offense averaged, I think, like 1.75 points per trip inside the 40. And you look at Ohio State defensively right now, third in the country in red zone defense. So, you know, it's 2019. You have to be able to pass the ball. But the one spot where you still need to be able to run is in the money territory. And that's been a struggle for multiple seasons for Michigan State's offense right now.
If you'd offered me, honestly, when I was digging into this game, and this is why even, you know, when you have four or five data points, it's always fascinating. For as close attention as we pay, you know, we may not know all the players and the rosters and the two deeps and all that, but you could honestly offer me any amount of money in the world, Payne, and told me, hey, what team has the receiver that actually leads the conference in receiving yards? There was no way I was going to come up with Michigan State.
I don't even know his name. What's his name?
Daryl Stewart. And so that's how I felt.
Actually,
I didn't know the dude's
know that name.
I didn't know the dude's name before, but I didn't know his 556 yards receiving were going to lead the conference. So it'll beg the question if Brian Lewerke can stretch this Ohio State defense and maybe put a little bit of a scare into the Buckeyes. I guess when I look at this game, and this is probably more of a macro discussion than it is a micro for just this contest, do we think the market has caught up to Ohio State fast enough, or does this team continue to have a greater ceiling? Because we don't ever like to overreact, and I know guys that watch more college, well, I don't want to say necessarily more, but who have opinions that resonate, the Joel Klatts of the world, the Kirk Herbstreits, have called Ohio State the best team in the country. I hate to say it, but they've looked to me, other than maybe LSU, to put together the most dominant performances, even against inferior opposition, at least through 4 or 5 weeks.
So just kind of looking at our core power number, you know, the line is a little inflated, without question. The question is, has the market caught up? The number suggests it has, but the matchup is really interesting because there is this opportunity for things to snowball when you kind of break things down, because Ohio State's offense is dynamic. And if you force Sparty to kind of play catch up, things could go awry a little bit. The one thing that, you know, makes me a little nervous is Sparty's defense, the one thing that we can hang our hats on, coming off the worst defensive performance of the season. And that's what makes me nervous a little bit. You don't want to be out of form for a game like this. Last week was the first time in 16 games they allowed 30 or more points. So it's just, again, it's a bad time to potentially lose your confidence on the defensive side of the ball.
And one thing, too, to talk about, because we were on Michigan State in this game last year, and you talk about snowballing quickly, so of course it brought up a painful memory. Ohio State wasn't anywhere near the same offensive juggernaut last year when these two teams met as they are right now. That game was 7-6 for an extended stretch. Michigan State just couldn't get out of the shadow of their own end zone. Yeah. Ohio State's punter deserved the Ray Guy Award for how he performed in that contest, pinning Sparty inside the top five. But I think you raise an excellent point that the numbers can suggest one thing, but how does the game flow go? If Ohio State goes out there, they score on their opening drive. Michigan State, they force a 3-and-out, and Ohio State goes up 10-0. You can kind of throw some of those numbers out the window if Michigan State finds themselves in predictable passing downs.
Yeah, it gets pretty scary. And the one thing when I looked at defensively for Sparty, and I went back and watched last week's game, and I know they won, but it was touch and go for a long time. And Indiana really spread the Sparty defense out. They got their athletes in space. You could see Michigan State's defense, they were getting frustrated. And then when Sparty kind of tried to combat Indiana's speed and went zone, just a lot of quick passes, a lot of bubble screens for the Hoosiers. I was looking this morning, Penix completed 20 straight passes at one point last week. So something was seen on film by Indiana, because 64% of Penix pass attempts were 5 yards or less in the air. 48% of Penix pass attempts were at or behind the line of scrimmage. Now I know with Ryan Day's offense, and we've kind of talked about this ad nauseum, it's a little more vertical than it's been in years past with Urban. And obviously that's evident by Justin Fields right now. Shockingly, he leads all quarterbacks in the country in air yards. But I'm sure Day and Fields will look at the film and test Sparty's defense a few times early in a similar manner to Indiana, right? To see if things have been fixed in 6 days' time. Obviously not all doom and gloom for the Sparty defense, right? I don't want to make it sound like that, because right now they have the, you know, through 5 data points, the second most efficient defense in the entire country. They're holding opponents to 2 yards per rush attempt. They've created 11.5 negative plays per game so far this season on average. So, again, it's been a fantastic defense. They just had a little hiccup last week against Indiana, maybe looking ahead, you know, whatever it was. This is obviously far and away the toughest test for Ohio State's offense as well, right? They haven't faced a top 30 defense by our efficiency metrics yet. The one matchup to watch, obviously, is a Sparty D-line against Ohio State's offensive line, two dominant units. Whoever wins that battle, probably is going to win this side of the ball a little bit. And certainly if Michigan State can win enough battles, you know, they're going to probably keep this within the 20. The one thing that I've kind of been watching and I've been interested to see, and I was a little surprised by this. We know Ohio State's offensive line has historically been really good, but I didn't know what their unit would look like this year. It has been fantastic. It's improved virtually every single week. Last week against Nebraska, the O-line created an average of 4.3 yards of space before contact. So probably pretty fun to run behind that kind of line. Dobbins had a good game, but you know, credit to his offensive line. Now for him, he did force 5 missed tackles, but I think we'll know pretty quickly on this side of the ball who's winning the trench battle. And Michigan State's got to do a much better job this week than they did last week against Indiana.
One thing, but before we close the book on this game, and I want to run a theory by you, because I think we kind of touched on it last week, and it's kind of counterintuitive when you look at the game. Typically, when you have a favorite of this magnitude and such a low total, you would see a correlation between favorite and over instead of the other way around. But in my opinion, when I handicap this game, Payne, I think if Michigan State is going to cover in this spot, the game goes over the total. And the reason I say that is because it means Michigan State has to score. If this game stays under, it means Sparty has scored 7-10 points. I know the trend in the series has been to go under, but I find it hard to believe that this game is going to end up with Ohio State winning it somewhere in the ballpark of, you know, if the game were to go over the total, that it benefits Ohio State. I think the Buckeyes clamp down and you could see a favorite to under correlation more so than the other way around.
Interesting. Listen, you know, when we start talking about, again, covering a number that's as high as 20, it's a little different. We need Michigan State's defense. And I say we, like I'm on the game. I'm not. Michigan State's defense is,
well, we do have Michigan State's win total, yes, so this would be a hell of a big win if they can pull off the outright upset.
That is true. That is true. Michigan State's defense obviously has to show up this week. But at the same time, I don't think, just looking at Ohio State's offense, how good it's been, how Michigan State struggled with Indiana's athletes last week, that they're going to be able to completely shut down Ohio State here. So it certainly is going to be a Michigan State offense that's going to have to provide some points here. you know, Michigan State's defense has to rebound this week. That's the biggest thing. Can they get back on track? Again, it's not all doom and gloom. They've been fantastic overall this season. It is Ohio State's toughest test to date, as I alluded to. But if Ohio State gets out, it's really going to create some pressure on Michigan State's offense to score. And at that point, with some of those injuries along the offensive line, whether they're creating an explosive play offensively like we've been stunned they've done so far, or it's Ohio State's defensive line creating some havoc in the backfield, which could lead to some interceptions or turnovers, you know, maybe you can make a case here. I don't see much on this game for me right now. So that's kind of where I'm at. I don't want to talk myself into something here.
No. I think if Michigan State can hold the Buckeyes to less than 28 points this weekend, it would be a massive victory, given how good this offense has looked. But we talk about it all the time. As we get into October, that's where rubber kind of meets the road, and we get a much better indication of who these teams are as the level of competition on every single front gets ratcheted up. And, you know, apparently someone in my household has a strong opinion on it maybe being a live underdog.
There you go. I hear. First thing in the morning. Who's coming to the door?
She's getting a little fired up. You know, I'm not sure what's going on downstairs. Maybe a lot of commotion outside the neighborhood as we approach sunrise or whatever the hell it is at 7 a.m. out here on the West Coast. But Michigan State, Ohio State, definitely an interesting game to watch. Not sure there's much to make a strong case from a wagering perspective. Five big games all in the books, all broken down as eloquently as we possibly can with stuff to hopefully get you to the window for your pools and whatever else you may do to try and entertain yourself on the weekends. But before we close up shop, Payne, one final order of business to transact around these fine parts.
Yeah, we've kind of hinted at it a couple times. Let's use Michigan here. Let's lay the points with the Wolverines. This is kind of their last-ditch effort to figure out what they are. There's certainly some value in the number. We're just going to find out if they're the real deal on the field here. So for me, and you kind of hinted at this yesterday, when threes popped, that's the number we kind of gravitated towards. There is a lot of 3.5 out there right now. It's plus money. So for me, I'm looking for three, whether it's on a cheap buy, which we have the opportunity to do now, or whether it's waiting it out because Iowa does, you know, apparently right now attracting 70% of the tickets. I like Michigan at three. So if we have to get there in the buy or wait it out, that's kind of the number we want to use here. So I like Michigan. I think they show up this week. I think this is a big test for them. I think program wise, this probably, and it's odd to say, one of the bigger games in the Harbaugh era at Michigan, because if you drop this one, then there's some real question marks. So I like what I saw last week, as I alluded to. You can go back to the top of the show. We'll have it time stamped on our thoughts on this game if you're someone who's decided to just not listen to the podcast and go right to the best bet. I like how Michigan was able to run the ball last week, got back to a lot of their zone running principles. I think that's a benefit. I do think Iowa's defense has, you know, benefited from playing some poor offenses so far. And the one offense that they played, they really struggled against with Iowa State, regardless of what the scoreboard said. The yard per play were outrageous. I think Michigan, as you kind of alluded to, has enough weapons here to make that Iowa secondary pay a little bit. So let's lay the points here with Michigan.
And here I was hoping that we were going to get a best bet on the big FCS game between Butler and Stetson. How you disappoint me sometimes, my friend, when it comes to where we're plunking down our cash.
That's an interesting game.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the first thing. I could barely tell you the nick. Actually, that's not true. I could tell you the nickname of both those teams. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. You, of course, can follow me there as well at Todd Furman. Follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Five big games all in the books. And another fine show, Payne. Week 6 of a college football season. Time flies when you're having fun, huh?
Love college football.
Yeah. If you say it.
I got to tell you, I was actually looking forward to Saturday college football. And after we like finalized all the work and, you know, I go to turn on the TV here at like noon on Saturday and I'm like searching for the good games. It was brutal last week. It was terrible. I had to like go find something to do. I went out and grabbed some lunch, became a normal human. And so finally came home, watched some of the late games, but the card wasn't very good in terms of viewership, especially with that early slate.
Well, see, now you can watch Michigan and Iowa kick things off at noon Eastern, roll it into Florida and Auburn at 3:30 Eastern, and then figure out what the hell you want to do with the rest of your life.
Yeah. Michigan State, Ohio State's probably a pretty good game.
So there's no doubt. There'll be plenty of good games, and we can only hope for better schedules as we get into the heart of conference play. But any final words of wisdom, lasting advice? Your book on how to pick up women in local grocery stores will be out as a bestseller, what, by 2026?
There you go. No, that's it. Continue supporting the podcast. Tell a friend, tell a co-worker, tell a family member. We greatly appreciate it. The numbers again are through the roof, and so we want to continue to give back. And so we're looking at NFL week 6 podcast. We will announce another iTunes winner. So go to iTunes, leave a 5-star review and a nice little comment. You're automatically entered to win the iTunes Bet the Board swag pack, which is some gear and some Visa gift cards and things of that nature. So once you leave a 5-star review and a nice little comment, you get automatically entered into this little automated generator, and up pops a name. You could potentially win the swag pack. So continue to support the podcast. Go to iTunes, 5-star review, and you are automatically entered for the swag pack.
We can appreciate it more than we'll ever be able to put into words. All the loyal listeners that have turned this into probably one of the single largest sports betting podcasts independently affiliated. So thank you for your continued loyalty and listenership. And with a Michigan ticket in your pocket come Saturday afternoon, we'll see you at the window.